This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, Blackberries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books.
Chapter 30. Detective Rios parked his police car in back of an evidence van near the car lot. He just finished taking statements from the diners and come to take a look at the mayhem. Firefighters had cordoned off the area around the downed power line while workers tried to get the power back on. Mobile work lights hooked up to generators illuminated the damage. Laying on its side on top of a row of crushed cars, the 18-wheeler looked like a giant sea creature that had been beached. The shadows of balloons and waving red flags in the building behind made it look like one of the accidents that his son would stage with his toys. Rios walked over to the cab truck where Simmons was kneeling. "What the hell did this kid do now?" he asked.
"People in the diner confirm it was him?" asked Simmons.
"The ones inside did. The ones outside that chased him are a little confused."
"Like the people back at the mall?" she asked.
"Yeah." Rios stood back and looked at the lot from a different angle. He looked at where the trailer had ripped open. There was another row of smashed cars in front of it, not visible from the street. A utility worker in a bucket at the end of a crane arm worked to unhook the power cables from the broken pole. Simmons stood up.
"Any idea what he would be doing at the truck stop, besides planning the world's worst joyride?"
Rio shook his head.
"I don't think he was after the truck. One of the other rigs was broken into. It doesn't seem like he was trying to steal it, though. The driver's a bit disoriented right now. I can't tell if anything was missing."
Simmons waved an arm at the rig.
"If all he was after was petty theft, then why go through all the trouble of stealing a tractor-trailer truck, driving it a quarter mile, and then causing $1 million worth of property damage?"
"He's a one-man doomsday machine. It's what he does," said Rios. Simmons shook her head.
"I don't buy it. The kid's got no priors, no history of domestic abuse, nothing even marginal. Unless some Facebook photos pop up of him wearing women's underwear while reading Soldier of Fortune, I think we're just dealing with a person who's reacting to everything that happened today."
"Sometimes people just snap," said Rios.
"I don't buy that. People with erratic behavior sometimes go way out of line and do something horrific. But there's almost always signs before."
"The breakup with the girlfriend?
What about it? Everyone goes through those breakups. I think we're just looking at a convenient explanation."
Simmons paused for a moment.
"I saw his girlfriend's face. But I also saw the boyfriend, too. I don't know if it's what it looks like. We've been too focused on the mall, we haven't even done any proper forensics."
Rios folded his arm. "What about the parking officer?"
"I don't know. We just don't know yet. When you talk to the people at the diner, the ones inside, did they say anything different about what the witnesses have said?"
asked Simmons.
"They could identify him. Not much else."
Simmons bit on the edge of a nail as she thought.
"What did they say about the people who chased after him?"
Rios pulled the notebook from his back pocket and looked at it.
"They said it looked like they wanted to kill him, which was understandable."
"Did they say kill specifically?"
Rios looked back at his notes. "One of them said murder, another said tear apart. Now, those are some pretty harsh words for someone doing a smash and grab.
I think, after what happened at the mall today, half this city would like to murder him."
Simmons held up a finger. Something just came to her.
"You said the people chasing him didn't know who he was."
"Yeah, but they saw the other man chasing after him."
"The trucker with the gun? They didn't know him either?" asked Simmons.
"Yeah, he was the one who caught him breaking into the other truck."
"Wait a second."
Simmons looked down at the street toward the truck stop.
"If you hear a gun go off and look out the window and see a man running away from another man with a gun, who do you think the victim is? Assuming the guy with the gun isn't a cop.
Rios arched an eyebrow. Simmons continued.
The men in the diner who went outside automatically, without hesitation, go into vigilante mode and decide to chase after Mitchell Roberts. They ignore the man with the gun and decide to have to murder the guy who was trying to run away. That's messed up, and it doesn't make sense.
Simmons walked over to the hood of the truck. She kneeled down to look at the bloody smear near the driver's side door.
Did the men who chased him have any injuries?
A few. I saw some cuts on their faces and a lot of bloody knuckles.
From what? Asked Simmons.
Trying to get him out of the cab, according to the people in the diner.
Who uses their forehead to try to smash open a window? She pointed to a bloody print on the metal bracing around the windshield. Or beats their hands to a pulp, smashing a steel frame.
Rio shrugged.
I've seen that lots of times.
On someone who wasn't psychotic on drugs.
Well, me neither.
Let me ask you another question. When you saw the men back there, what made you think it was Mitchell Roberts?
Was it the statements from the people in the diner?
And I'm not talking about the fact that we're only 2 miles away from one of the stakeouts.
Rios got her point.
The injuries on their faces that reminded me of this morning and the mall.
What can we say about the injuries here and the mall as far as the cause?
Rios nodded.
For the most part, they were self-inflicted while they were pursuing the suspect.
He paused for a moment.
So you think the injuries this morning were self-inflicted as well?
It would just seem to fit the pattern. All the injuries were the result of chasing Roberts, said Simmons.
Rio shook his head. His mind went back into the grisly scene at the escalator and the people who fell off the roof.
You saw what happened back at the mall. Who in their right mind would let that happen?
Someone scared, Rios. Someone running for their life who can't stop to look back.
Simmons pointed to the bloody knuckle prints on the hood, then took a step back from the wrecked tractor-trailer truck.
These people weren't chasing the devil. He was running from it.
Steinmetz looked up from the computer display and wiped his eyes. He hoped it was just the fatigue. He knew that was wishful thinking. He looked over at the 30-year-old man with thick, dark hair and a perpetual 5 o'clock shadow.
You've double-checked these, Nick?
I checked 4 times and 7 samples. Also the same kind of elevated peptides.
He leaned over and touched the tip of a pen to the screen.
You can see here, the spike on the neurokinin C. Here!
Steinmetz took off his glasses and wiped his eyes again, as was his habit when he felt stress. He'd been doing it a lot lately. His lab assistant, Nick Arturis, hesitated to speak. Finally, he couldn't hold it in any longer.
It looks like... I know what it looks like, Nick. Steinmetz came across much harsher than he meant to.
But Great Wall was supposed to stop this.
Great Wall was rushed.
Maybe. This is what it looks like when it works? Asked Nick, hopefully.
Maybe. Maybe. I gotta call the big man. Go back and ask Selena to help you run everything through the sequencer. I want to send it through our internal gene bank.
Nick nodded, then closed the door behind him as he left. Steinmetz picked up the phone and called Baylor. After going through a forwarding center, he picked up after 2 rings.
What is it, Ari?
Asked Baylor.
It's not good, Stephen.
It can't be Mongolian flu.
It's not! We couldn't find any variant there. We're looking again. It's just that it shows all the symptoms of Mongolian after it recedes. All the elevated peptides, neurokinin, it's all there.
Fuck, said Baylor.
Is it a variant of some kind? We're looking right now to see if our screener was too imprecise and miscalled it, but I'm skeptical, said Steinmetz. We have to consider the possibility that...
No, said Baylor, interrupting.
That's technically impossible.
Well,
Ari, listen to me. That's not an option. For all we know, this could be Great Wall doing what it's supposed to do.
Baylor paused.
One of the things we looked into was the possibility of using the same mechanism that Mongolian flu did as an airborne solution for crowd control.
This was news to Steinmetz.
Good Lord, Stephen! What kind of crowd are you trying to control? Baylor ignored the question. We have to consider the possibility that somebody else had the same idea. You could bypass the virus altogether and create a biological agent that would cause the same reaction as long as people were exposed to it. Turn it off, and the reaction stops. Do we tell DHS about this? Baylor thought for a moment. I'm going to send a containment team down there. We'll hold off now so we can protect the integrity of Great Wall. Since we have no reason to think it's an infectious agent, it's not that serious. Steinmetz had seen the news reports of what happened in the mall earlier that day. He was afraid to find out what Baylor thought was serious. We need to be there when they apprehend this man and make sure the right precautions are taken with whatever kind of dispersant he was using, said Baylor. Is there a chance we could get a blood sample from the man? After we catch him, certainly. No, I mean, is there one now? Asked Steinmetz. Not that I'm aware of. Why? I just wanted to have a cross-check. Something involving Great Wall. Forget about Great Wall, Ari. I need you to look at some of the blood samples and find some kind of evidence of a dispersant. We need to figure out how it got into the system. Call back in a couple hours. I'm going to take a jet down there and meet up with the containment team. Baylor hung up. Steinmetz put down the phone and walked back into the lab. He called over to one of his assistants. Selena, can you do a search in the blood database for a Mitchell Roberts? I'd like to see if we have access to a sample anywhere. The official one or the back door? The back door database was an index Steinmetz had helped develop for Baylor. Using genetic fingerprinting, it matched blood samples from known donors with anonymous donors and had a prediction algorithm that could calculate the likelihood of someone being related to other individuals in the database. Even if someone had never given a blood sample, they could often trace a drop of blood back to a specific person if their family members had ever donated blood. The database was not only a secret to only a few people outside the lab, but it was highly illegal. Steinmetz only used it sparingly. Use back door, Selena. Chapter 32. Mitchell drove the boat for a half hour up the intracoastal, then down a canal. He tied it off to a tree next to the highway. Climbed out of the boat and looked over the concrete embankment that separated the highway from the canal. Across the road, he could see 24-hour box store Supercenter. That's what he was looking for. Before he went into total hiding, he needed a few more things. It was a calculated risk, but one he needed to take if he was going to avoid human contacts until things sorted out. Whatever that meant. He waited until there was no cars coming or going on the road, then ran across it. Came to a small hill that ran along in front of the parking lot and looked over the hedge that topped it. He counted 14 cars in the parking lot. Usually there was some kind of rent-a-cop driving a car around. Mitchell spotted him at the far end of the mall, parked near the other entrance. If Mitchell walked normally past the car, he could get inside without too much trouble, just as long as the window wasn't down. Before he went shopping, he needed to take care of something while he was in the parking lot. Mitchell found an opening at the hedge and walked over to one of the cars. Making sure that nobody was looking, he knelt down to the license plate and pulled out a fishing knife he'd found on the boat. Using the flat edge, he unfastened the screws holding the license plate onto the car. Mitchell tucked the plate into his jacket and into the back waistband. He walked over to another car and did the same thing. He wanted to get as many license plates as he could, but settled for only one more. He had no plans to use them. He just wanted to give his pursuers a strong reason to believe he'd stolen a car. The multiple missing plates would frustrate their search. He tucked the third plate behind the others and stood up. The security vehicle was still in the same spot. Mitchell looked to make sure that there was no one else in the parking lot and walked towards the nearer entrance. If he saw anyone coming through the doors towards him, he readied himself to run around the side of the building. Through the glass doors, he could see an old man in a red vest working as the Supercenter's door greeter, a polite term for shoplifting deterrent. Mitchell knew there was no way around the man. He was counting on the fact that once the man noticed him, he'd abandon his post. Mitchell tried to remember the layout of the store so he could get everything he needed as quickly as possible.
Mitchell took a deep breath, smoothed the back of his hair, then walked through the main entrance. Mitch entered the store. He tried to pass as far away from the old man as he could, but it didn't matter. 2 seconds after Mitch walked through the door, the man's teeth were bared and his eyes narrowed. Mitch kept walking. "Take it easy, old-timer. I don't want you to have a heart attack." The old man lunged forward at him. Mitch walked faster, easily outpacing the old man as he tried to move toward him as fast as he could. Mitch kept going straight down the aisle, darted to the right into the hardware section. He searched the shelves for what he needed. The old man rounded the corner just as Mitch found it. Mitch jogged down the shelves and headed back toward the aisle. He ripped open the container and pulled out what he needed. When the footsteps grew fast behind Mitch, he broke into a light run. He didn't want to attract attention from anyone else in the store. Behind him, he could hear the old man let out a low-pitched groan. Mitch increased his speed and headed to the men's bathroom at the back of the store. Down the aisle, he got sight of a young couple with a shopping basket looking at DVDs. Mitch didn't know how far whatever made people attack him worked, but he was sure he was going to have to deal with them after the old man. Footsteps were getting closer. Mitchell reached the bathroom and pushed the door open. He quickly ran around the back of the door and waited. The old man ran in after him a few seconds later and charged into the center of the bathroom. Mitch slipped around the door and pulled it shut behind him. The old man started to pound on the door. Mitch couldn't hold it shut forever. Somebody was going to come sooner or later when they heard the noise the man was making. Mitch pushed the door open slightly, and a clawed hand came at his face. He slid his zip tie around the hand, then attached it to one he'd fastened to the door handle. He cinched them both tight, making sure that the old man was fastened to the door. It might hurt the man's wrist if he fought it, but it would keep him at a safe distance. Mitch walked back toward the sporting goods section and grabbed a few things. Wooden baseball bat, paintball gun, and extra ammo. Found a large duffel bag and shoved them inside. He ran over to the camping section and started shoving freeze-dried food packages into the duffel bag. Grabbed a few other camping tools, then went to another aisle. From behind, he could hear the sound of two pairs of footsteps running toward him. Mitch looked over his shoulder and saw the girl and her boyfriend running full speed. Mitch ran away from them and turned down the aisle that led to the toy department. He turned into what he thought was the right aisle and realized he'd made a mistake. He ran down the aisle and turned around to the next end cap. Mitch scanned the shelves for what he needed. He knew it was a borderline stupid idea. He just wanted to try it before he used the baseball bat. He'd heard enough people that day. The couple came around the corner, filled with rage, and closed in on him. Mitch ripped open the bag of marbles and threw them on the floor. The man and the women tripped and skidded across the smooth tile. The man's head smacked into the metal shelf, and the girl fell face first. Mitch ripped open two more bags and scattered them around the couple as they tried to get up. He shoved more bags of marbles into his bag and ran back to the hardware gun section of the store. Mitch found a shelf filled with pepper spray canisters and began shoving them into his bag. He got the safety off one and held onto it. Mitch ran back into the hardware section and grabbed a few more things. At the other end of the store, he could hear the sound of merchandise being dropped and footsteps hurrying in his direction. It was time to go. Mitch headed back to the center aisle and ran toward the exit the old man had abandoned. A heavyset woman in t-shirt, shorts, flip-flops was running at him, rolls of body fat shaking like a hula skirt. Behind her was a pigtailed 7-year-old in hot pursuit. Both pairs of eyes were bloodshot. He ran to the right end of the clothing section and started weaving through the racks. Another man in a red vest came running at Mitch from behind a row of shelves. Mitch sprayed the man in the eyes with a pepper spray. The man let out a roar but didn't stop coming after him. He was blinded but kept swinging. Mitch knocked over 2 clothing racks to trip the man up. He looked to his left and saw the mother getting close. Mitch aimed a cloud of pepper spray at her, then tipped over a rack in her path. She went sprawling across the ground. Mitch looked around. He couldn't see the little girl because she was shorter than the racks. It was the sound of little footsteps coming from somewhere. He couldn't see where. Mitch moved away from the man and the little girl's mother and headed toward the exit. Suddenly, he felt a searing pain in the back of his thigh as the little girl bit him. Fuck! Mitch jerked away. Try to kick the girl without being too harsh. She just attacked his leg. Mitch looked at the can of pepper spray. He couldn't do it.
From the moment he entered, he knew there were surveillance cameras watching. At some point, authorities would see everything he did in the store. He couldn't bring himself to hurt the little girl any more than was necessary. Mitch kept pushing her away with his leg. He pulled a zip tie from his pocket and grabbed one of the girl's wrists, yanked her into a clothes rack before she could bite into his arm. He wrapped the zip tie around her tiny wrist and strapped her to the metal curtain bar of the clothes rack. Once he was confident she wouldn't chase after him after she left the store, Mitch ran toward the exit. The little girl snarled and spit. He could hear more footsteps behind him. He got a glimpse of two cashiers and four customers running at him. Mitch pulled out another bag of marbles, ripped it open, tossed the bag over his head. He could hear the sound of several bodies hitting the ground. There were still more footsteps. There were another bag of marbles. But a pair of footsteps still came after him. Mitch didn't want to be followed back to the boat. He turned around the corner that led to the exit and pulled a baseball bat out of the duffel bag. As soon as he was around the side of the wall, he knelt down and stuck the baseball bat to trip whoever was behind him. The man in the sheriff's deputy uniform ran past the corner, tripped on the bat. He skidded across the floor on his face. Not another cop, thought Mitch. He had no choice. He took the can of mace from the bag. Mitch walked over and sprayed the man a point blank as he tried to get up. Mitchell started to sneeze from being too close to the spray. The deputy screamed out and tried to claw at anything he could. Mitch ran through the automatic sliding glass doors and into the parking lot. He saw the sheriff's deputy's car parked on the curb. Christ, that guy got here fast, thought Mitchell. He looked at the parking lot. It still looked the same as when he came in, with the exception of the flashing blue light from the empty police car. Mitchell ran toward the far end of the lot. As he reached the hedge on top of the hill, it separated the mall from the parking lot and the highway. He saw three police cars racing toward the direction with their lights flashing. Mitchell ducked down behind the hedge and tried to figure out what to do next. The cars pulled into the parking lot and headed toward the front of the store. While their attention was on the front, Mitchell decided now was the best time to make a break for it. Climbed over the hedge and looked for traffic. The road was clear. Mitchell ran across the highway, climbed the concrete wall, found the spot where he tied his boat to the tree, threw the duffel bag filled with stolen goods inside. Mitchell untied the rope from the tree and shoved off. He didn't want to get caught next to the shore as he tried to get the engine going. He'd be too vulnerable like that. When the boat was 10 feet away from the shore, he gave the starting cord a pull. It took him 3 tries. Finally, it started. Mitchell aimed the bow away from the shore and headed up the canal back toward the intracoastal waterway. It wasn't uncommon for police to call in a police boat unit when they thought a suspect might be out near the water. Mitchell kept the boat going as fast as he could without attracting too much attention. As he entered the main waterway, he looked back and saw the police helicopter over the supercenter shining its spotlight on the parking lot below. Mitchell reached into the back of his pants, pulled out the license plates. He looked at the numbers and letters, then tossed them into the water where they sank to the bottom. Mitchell steered the little boat toward the large drawbridge that connected the inland part of the city to the beach. There was one more errand that Mitch had to do before the night was over.
This is an audiobook presentation of Public Enemy Zero by Andrew Main. Public Enemy Zero is available for only $1 at the Amazon Kindle store or via the Kindle app on all major tablets and smartphones, including iPads, iPhones, BlackBerries, Windows 7, and Android. It's also available on the Barnes & Noble Nook Store and Apple's iBooks. Or you can get a complete, uninterrupted copy of this audiobook at andrewmain.com/books.